Thank you very much for being here, and I would very much like to thank the organizers for inviting me and asking me to give a talk. I have to admit that after listening to the talk so far, I'm very much in awe when I see all this vast amount of technical expertise, which is also paired with the conceptual insights that has been presented so far. And as people have often started the talks, now I want to switch gear and want to be a bit more low level about all of this. I have to admit that I'm more of a mathematics person, and that is why I apologize in advance to you that most of my talk will just be from the realm of abstract nonsense, and probably rightfully so. What I want to talk about has to do with the question of that has been come up in this conference so far very often, that in the context of say spin foam models or tensor field theories or spin net models, that on one side you have a discretization which plays into the definition of your model, and then on the other side you have a notion of diffeomorphism invariance that you somehow want to include in your model. And you have a notion of renormalization where you want to introduce some flow along some scale, but since you don't have any scale, what do you do? And what I want to talk about is basically how all these things and how all these concepts look like from a mathematical perspective, and what are the structures that you would want to look at, and what one maybe can learn from that. So as I said, I will not be very model specific. I will just, you know, talk about some examples at the very end that might give some insight into what I mean. Okay, so the introduction is probably very unnecessary now, because all of you know why one should quantize gravity. I want to talk about what kinds of models basically I consider, so what the outset is that I'm talking about. And I want to talk about what coarse graining, and in particular the continuum limit, means for these kinds of models, and why for a mathematician that is very interesting, because that is exactly what one as a mathematician would do if you want to construct a measure on an infinite dimensional space. And I want to talk about then afterwards what takes up the notion of scale and RG flow in this context where you don't start with any notion of background so far. So you don't have a length to measure. And then in the end, I want to talk about some very, very easy examples which are nearly trivial, but which just should show you the basic ideas which are around. Okay, well, as I said, well, the introduction is very clear. I mean, we all know that we somehow want to talk about the classical theory of gravity and make it quantum, which means that in some way we want to make sense out of this path integral. And in fact, we don't just want to make sense of this path integral, but actually we want to make sense of these observables. So we don't believe that, you know, from a mathematical point of view, that these will actually ever be finite numbers, because this is a very vastly huge integral. But, you know, here we somehow take an expectation value of this observable. So this is an infinite integral, this is an infinite integral, and we somehow hope that the ratio is finite. Now, usually, historically, you all know this, then there's a perturbative ansatz to try to renormalize this. And you make a split from the metric into a Minkowski background and this graviton field here. And try to make a quantum theory for this H, basically. And then what you get is then, well, you turn the theory of renormalization technique, which like 40 years ago. And what you find is then that the usual machinery of renormalization doesn't work, because you somehow need infinitely many coupling constants in order to UV complete your theory. And so one way how to understand this non-renormalizability, which is a problem here, at least for me, is the idea that, well, in this parameter space, which consists of lots of different couplings, which describe your theory at different scales, you make an expansion around this free theory here, and you have a flow from the ultraviolet to the infrared, and you just have infinitely many couplings which, you know, flow into the direction of the free theory before you go out, which basically means that, you know, if you just make finitely many measurements, you really cannot determine which of these curves you actually are on, because there's an infinite dimensional space here where this line could potentially still vanish. So you don't just know by providing finitely many numbers what you're doing. There's another very important thing about general relativity, which you also don't know, and this will just be very briefly, is the fact that it has this symmetry where you act with a diffeomorphism on both the metric and the metafields at the same time, and the whole action is invariant. And since this is a local symmetry, you can constrain it to a finite region of space, this means that it's a gauge symmetry. That means, in fact, that those two different things should be physically equivalent. And this is very much connected to the idea of background independence, and in particular, it means that you have no a priori scale. And one of the ideas why perturbative renormalization might not work is that, in fact, you arbitrarily introduce a scale, and that might, since this breaks this gauge symmetry, that might just be a reason for why this original ansatz doesn't work. Okay, so let's talk. How much time do I have, actually?
30 minutes.
Okay, thanks. Let's talk about basic states and models that I want to introduce. All of these models are basically, there are several of these models, and they're actually subsumated under the name of holonomy spin foam models, although what you want to call them is basically up to you. The point is that they are a large class of models which are defined on an oriented embedded two complex. So I have a two complex which consists of vertices, edges, and faces, which are somehow embedded in a pre-given manifold somewhere. For each of these gammas, you have a configuration space, which is this curly A, depending on gamma, and this is just a product of group elements. So the idea is that the configuration space somehow is associated with lots of group elements that belong to this F. Additionally to that, you have a measure, which you call an amplitude function, which basically tells you how to integrate over the space of this, how to integrate over the space of these group variables. So this is basically your local state sum for this gamma. Okay, so there are many examples, obviously. I mean, you all know lattice gauge theory, where you have group elements which are associated with the edges. Those are the holonomies along the edges. And the path integral measure associated to this two complex, which very often is just the two complex or the two skeleton of a hypercubic lattice, you basically take the ordered product of holonomies around each plaquette, or they're not called faces in this approach, they're called plaquettes, and you have an action, usually the Wilson action. And then you do your integration, and then you compute things with it. The spin foam models are a slight generalization, which means that this factor of for group elements, well, first of all, you have different group elements, and second of all, the amplitude for the ordered product might be very different. And you also have, as Bianca told you, you have different functions here, which these E functions, which are somehow, in some way, should incorporate the simplicity constraints of the theory for you, and actually make this different from BF theory. So if you leave this E out, then you are supposed to just have BF theory here. And then, well, as far as I know, then you can generalize this even further and basically put in additional weights at these vertices, which contain information about what kind of tensors you want to contract if you want to play the game of tensor field theories, for instance. Okay, so these are just all examples, but as I said, I want to be model independent for what I talk next. So the point is we have some configuration space and we have some measure. So the way that I've presented this so far obviously has some clear limitations which you might not like, and obviously I can completely understand this. Well, first of all of these G's that I talked about are supposed to be compact, which means that a priori there's no Lorentzian signature, and this is not just a technical problem at this point. There's actually in particular, you know, remembering what Renate and Loyal talked about in her talk, it doesn't just work, apparently it doesn't just work to put a non-compact G at this point and just hope that you can somehow manage all these infinities that crop up. But the fluctuation of the causal structure is something which is, as I said, very, very, very badly understood so far, even in this context. Also, you might have noticed that I started out with a fixed manifold from the beginning, and I embedded all my two complexes in there, which means that there's a priori no sum over topologies. So the philosophy here is exactly that you have a differential manifold from the beginning, and you look at the quantum fluctuations of a field living on this manifold, which allows you to talk about diffeomorphisms of this manifold. But in particular, if you're from the group field theory or tensor field, transfer track, then as I said, you might obviously not like that. But unfortunately, this is something that you cannot do in this language so far. Despite all these drawbacks, I want to convince you that all of this is very useful, because there's a natural notion of continuum limit, which I am going to show you now. It gives rise to a natural notion of scale and RG flow, even without prescribing a background for you. And it also allows for the discussion of diffeomorphism invariance.
So, just a clarification, we have also models with non-compact V, which are well-defined, finite-metric sampling.
No, I don't like those. I mean, obviously, first of all, you could say, well, you still fix a causal structure in these models. Obviously, you do, because all of the all of the faces are space-like. So for one vertex amplitude, I mean, I agree. I mean, obviously, there's a way of defining, of removing the infinities well enough so that there's not a big deal. For larger two complexes, you can be very tough, like Wojtek-Kaminski, and you know, try to find out when you can make this a finite expression as well. But what I'm going to show you, in particular, this notion of cylindrical consistency, nobody has any idea of how to do that with the non-compact groups. Might do, yes. Yeah.
So if you're concerned with the cylindrical consistency, then I agree. But if you're concerned just with the divergence coming from the no compactness of the largest group, but those have been dealt with for generic complexes of this group of models. So we know that it fits the output.
Yes, no, I completely agree.
Two different things. Exactly.
No, I mean the making finite of the amplitude. I agree. This is something that you can do. I mean, there's a choice involved in this gauge fixing, obviously, but how this plays together with this notion of diffeomorphism invariance is something that I'm not sure that anybody has actually clarified. Okay, so let's take these models now and let's talk about coarse graining and continuum limit, and in particular, let's talk about how a continuum limit here might actually be achieved. So these two complexes, obviously, since they are embedded, they obey a natural partial ordering. So I can look at one two complex, and I can look at another two complex, and I say that this second two complex is finer than the first two complex if the faces of this one, the faces of gamma can be composed out of faces of gamma dash. And the edges of gamma can be composed out of edges of gamma dash. And the vertices of gamma are vertices of gamma dash. So in that sense, this gamma dash is really fine. And that is a notion that you can see when you look at how these are embedded. And now not every two of these gammas can be compared, but obviously for each two gammas in gamma dash, there is actually, you always find a finer one. So this is actually important to work in this semi-analytic category. Yes?
And is there a problem that that they can be embedded in different ways, so that gamma is completing gamma prime? And
in that sense, there would be two different two complexes, in this language. Okay, so there's another input, which is a projection map, which contains information about the coarse graining, which is the following. If you have a configuration space associated to the fine two complex, and you have a configuration space associated to the coarse two complex, then you need to be given a way of saying, well, if I know all the holonomies on this, I know what the coarse-grained holonomies on that are. So you need a projection map from this A gamma dash to the A gamma. So the very easy example from the lattice gauge theory is just, well, you have just group elements along edges, and the group element along this large edge here is just the ordered product of group elements along these finer edges here. So this is just the easiest example, and for these other models, you can actually write down different coarse graining maps, which tell you something about how these two spaces are related to each other. And now from a mathematical point of view, what you would want to do is not take some strange limit in which you only look at one, two complex and make it finer and finer and finer, but actually you want to consider all two complexes at the same time. And if you do that, you can form something which is called a projective limit. You can take all these A gamma, these configuration spaces, and glue them together in a nice way to get a huge, hugely infinite dimensional space here. So I want to stress again that this is not a limit case of these A gammas. So it's not just one A gamma and you take it finer and finer and finer, but actually you take all of the A gammas together, together with a consistency condition between them.
So A gamma is just a combinatorial object here? Or do you associate also information to the links, like the group elements and stuff?
No, this A gamma, well, first of all, it depends on the two complex. So it even carries information about how it's embedded in the manifold. And it knows about all the different values of group elements that you have associated to the two complex. So for instance, in lattice gauge theory, this would, for a given lattice, would be the space of all configurations, which means all group elements associated to edges. That would be an element in one A gamma.
But so the lattice gauge theory, if you were doing a blocking transformation, you would be forgetting about the intervals that you've been doing over a finite length.
Yes, exactly. But I'll show you in a second where this step crops up again here. Now, this space of generalized continuum connections, this A bar, it's a very nice space from a mathematical point of view. Well, first of all, it's a compact Hausdorff space, which gives you lots of mathematical machinery to work with. Second of all, which is very nice, is that the space of classical connections, which I cannot show you because, here we go, the space of classical smooth connections which live on the manifold are actually a dense subset here. And this is actually a phenomenon which you always have in any kind of quantum theory. We can actually define the path integral measure in a rigorous way. For instance, in the case of the Wiener measure, so is then you write down the Feynman path integral for a particle that moves along a line, and actually you find that the space you have to be looking at is not the space of all smooth paths, but actually the space of all continuous paths. So usually the quantum configuration space is always much larger in a certain sense, but you know, still contains the classical original configuration space of your continuum theory as a dense set. Okay, so in order to construct a path integral measure on this huge space, you basically take now all the single measures that you, or the single path integral state sum measures on each of these A gamma. And in order to glue all of them together, these measures actually have to satisfy a condition as well, which is the following: that if you have an observable and you take an expectation value with respect to gamma, and this observable is a continuous function on one of these A gamma, then you can just basically compose this with a projection map and take the expectation value of gamma dash. So that is what is called by cylindrical consistency. And if you have this notion, if you have all these mu gamma satisfying this, then you can glue this all together for a mu, which is actually a very nice Radon measure on this space. Okay, so let's go into a bit more detail. So first of all, where's the physical intuition of all of this? So what does that mean? What it means is the following. You can think of these A gamma, which are associated with single two complexes embedded in the manifold, as kind of a finite dimensional slice through this infinite dimensional space. And this gamma provides a cutoff in the sense that you can only look at finitely many degrees of freedom of the whole continuum theory. Obviously, the continuum theory does stuff about things, about all has information about holonomies along all the manifold, but each A gamma just lets you look at finitely many of those. So in that sense, the two complexes are the scales in this description, simply because they provide a cutoff. You cannot look at anything which is, so to speak, finer than a two complex which somehow lives in the manifold. And only finitely many holonomies are measurable at the time. And the expectation value of observables, as I said, this cylindrical consistency condition, now exactly becomes the equation for the Wilsonian renormalization group flow. Now, if you don't want to talk about measures, but if you want to talk about actions, then this is the equation that I've written down here is exactly the equation for an effect of action that you get after a block spin transformation that might allude to your question. So on this gamma dash, you have some measure. On this gamma, you might have a different measure. Obviously, you have two complexes, and you have just two different path integral measures, or two different mu's, and which you can parameterize by, say, you can write in this form, and you can write as depending on different parameters, gi. And if you write out this equation with this form, then you basically get exactly this equation for the effective action at the coarser scale being the integral over the effective action at the finer scale under a certain condition here, which is basically the coarse graining map here. This is the delta. Okay, so now I want to emphasize that this tells you, first of all, about what renormalization group flow is in this context and also what a scale is. Well, and I also want to emphasize that what you usually have in lattice gauge theory is a special case for that. So in lattice gauge theory, you don't look at all two complexes, but because you have a background metric, you can actually look at, say, hypercubic lattices in Minkowski space or hypercubic lattices in Euclidean space, and not look at all two complexes, but actually order them in terms of their length of an edge here. And you can actually have a sequence of all of these lattices, and then at each step, so to speak, you perform something like a block spin transformation, and you get a sequence of coupling constants, which tells you basically about how your theory looks like on different scales. Now, without a background, what you need to do is actually consider all of these gammas which are embedded at the same time, and that actually really means that, well, you don't have just a sequence of these two complexes, but you have this uncountably infinite set of all two complexes which are somehow embedded in each other in this very, very intricate way. So the convergence up here runs along the sequence, the convergence down here runs along something which is called a filter in mathematics. Now, just very briefly talking about the Hamiltonian formulation of this, I mean, if you have a manifold with boundary, then what you can do is you can let your two complex touch the boundary, and that gives you group elements which are associated to the boundary, letting you in particular talk about the Hilbert space of functions on these. Now, the functions that live on there are actually also just observables. So you can take the expectation value with respect to this two complex gamma, and that just basically gives you a definition for, say, in this case where you have an initial boundary and a finite boundary, gives you a prescription for the physical inner product between those, say, the state which lives on here and the state that lives on there. And yeah, this provides a physical inner product in the sense of actually of a rigging map in the sense of refined algebraic quantization. And the cylindrical consistency actually of these measures and gamma tell you not only that, yeah, well, you can basically choose whatever two complex you like in your family of two complexes that you're considering, as long as it, so to speak, transitions between those two states. It also tells you that the actual continuum Hilbert space really is the directed limit of all these single Hilbert spaces associated to one graph. And these then actually become the amplitude maps that Bianca has been talking about. Now, let me very quickly talk about what the diffeomorphism group action now does, because in this context now, we can just talk about what does diffeomorphism invariance mean. Well, because we have a manifold and we have never thrown away the manifold, but we just kept it as a so to speak, background structure, not a metric background structure, but just, you know, a manifold with a differential structure. We know what a diffeomorphism is. And in particular, the smooth classical connections can just be acted on with a diffeomorphism. It just shifts stuff around in the manifold. And this action can just be very easily continued to the quantum continuum space up here, the space of generalized continuum connections. And you just have to say what that does on each gamma, since this is just basically gluing together all these simple A gammas. And well, it does what you think it does. It just shifts around the two complex. And now you can ask yourself, well, I have this measure on this A bar. Yeah? Well, it's embedded in the manifold. So the vertices lie at points in the manifold. You just deform the manifold. That means you deform your...
But
the,
up until now, that information wasn't used at all, was it?
No, so far you haven't really used the fact that all of these are embedded. It's just, so far it was excess baggage. You could have just done exactly the same thing and think of some abstract combinatorial complex that lives somewhere. This is the first point where it actually needed that this is embedded in a manifold. You're absolutely right. And well, you have all these, you have this, say you have one of these measures. It's actually now a well-defined notion to ask, well, what is, or is this measure invariant under diffeomorphisms, on the diffeomorphisms on this manifold? So what does this mean? Well, and as a condition for all these expectation values, it means that if you take an expectation value of an observable, which lives on some, which is supported on some two complex, then if you switch this around and take the expectation value then you just get the same number. You get the same expectation value out in the end. And this tells you that, well, if you push forward the measure with the diffeomorphism, then you get the same measure again. And I want to stress what a very, very strong condition that now becomes, simply because you know you have this large family of two complexes, and there's just so many different ways of embedding these two complexes into each other. In particular, if you look at these two examples down here, that say you have one observable which is supported on these two complexes, which say is the holonomy around this curve here, or the holonomy around this face, then obviously you can just deform this with a diffeomorphism. But cylindrical consistency now tells you that, well, if you take the expectation value of this one, then you also have to be able to get the same number if you don't look at the same observable on this two complex, but on a refined two complex. So now the same notion appears here. And since this is a partially ordered family, well, there's a notion of how to refine how to find a refinement that is a refinement of both of these, of gamma and of the diffeomorphically transformed gamma at the same time. And this is horrible two complex up here, which is probably not very visible at all. But the point is now that, well, you can take this O and push this forward with these projection maps, and you can take the phi of O and push this forwards with a projection map, and you get two different observables which now live on the same gamma dash. And the condition of diffeomorphism invariance tells you that these two numbers actually have to be the same. So this is, as I said, this is a very, very strong condition which singles out quite a lot of measures. And I just want to mention very quickly, because I'm probably running out of time, that if you have, for instance, assume you have something like this, then triangulation independence of your model is an immediate consequence, for instance, which is why one thinks that these two notions are connected very strongly. Okay, so maybe let's talk about some very, very easy examples before I have to go. These examples are very trivial, so you can all do them on a napkin. They are two-dimensional manifolds with a gauge group U1, and there's a family of measures that I give you for all two complexes, and these measures depend on, well, this is basically a Gaussian factor. They depend on some A's which are associated to phases and some thetas which are associated to phases. So these are, so to speak, my coupling constants, and I have infinitely many of them because obviously I have infinitely many gammas, and these parameterize the measures associated to the two complex. Now, as I said, well, the coarse grinding map is the usual one that you would know or take from lattice gauge theory. And these are the renormalization group equations. This is the rewriting of the condition of cylindrical consistency now. This tells you that what do these numbers have to, what conditions do they have to satisfy in order to allow for a continuum limit so that you can glue all those measures together. Well, and the answer is that these A's, which are supposed to always be positive, well, the A associated to this phase should be a sum of the A's of these phases, and the theta associated to these phases should be the sum of the thetas associated to all of the smaller phases, weighted with the relative orientation of the phases. Now, and then there's an obvious solution to that, which you all can immediately see. One comes from a two-dimensional metric, the other one comes from a two-form, so that these A's just are the area. These A's behave as an area, right? So this is the area of a phase, and this is the integral of a two-form over a phase, right? So if I give you a two-dimensional metric and I give you a two-form, then I have a solution to these equations. And that you can even look at certain limit solutions. Well, theta equals zero is the obvious 2D Young-Mills. Theta unequal to zero, but G going to zero is a well-defined notion of, well, an integral over A where the curvature is, or a curvature of A is somehow peaked around this theta. Yes, exactly. That's a good point. No, this is the continuum limit, right? The notion of cylindrical consistency just tells you about whether there's a continuum limit or not. Now you can ask the question, well, which of these are diffeomorphism invariant? Now, then you basically play the same game and you get additional conditions on these A, which basically just let two of these solutions survive. And obviously one is the Ashikar-Lewandowski measure or the degenerate fixed point. And the other one is, what would be Dijkgraaf-Witten theory if it were a finite group, for instance, right? So for all of these, solutions to the equations of motion, solutions to the renormalization group equation, but the notion of diffeomorphism invariance gives you an additional condition, which in the end singles out only two solutions. So, I might comment on the fact of what that has to do with non-renormalizability, but I will not talk about this here. There's a similar example with a quantum group instead of a classical group, just to show you that all of these things also work in the quantum group context, but I won't talk about this either. I just want to again remind you that there's a clear notion of background independent renormalization, a Wilsonian renormalization group flow. And the scale is actually the discretization of the manifold given by a two complex. The RG flow equations result from coarse graining scales, and the cylindrical consistency flow not along one line, but along a partially ordered set. And that tells you about whether the continuum limit exists. And the condition of diffeomorphism invariant is something that you can ask additionally, and that singles out solutions where exactly there's no background anymore. And obviously there are lots of challenges about whether the question of whether two complexes are actually sufficient or not, whether you should give up locality or not, which you probably should, so that these gammas that you look at don't have this nice product form, and in particular how to include non-compact groups. But I will stop here. Thanks. Thank you.
So I'm a bit confused. You have to embed the complex in a manifold, but this manifold, the dimensionality of this manifold, does it matter?
Yes, of course it matters.
So it's going to be a two-dimensional manifold or a four-dimensional manifold?
Well, whatever you want. I mean, the example was two-dimensional, but I mean, the models are made in such a way that you can put in whatever you want. Now, the question might probably be, well, how does the two complex know about this, about the dimensionality of the manifold? Well, it turns out that if you want to look at interesting models, you find actually that you shouldn't take all two complexes, but only two complexes which have sufficient amount of information. So for instance, if you look at the topological field theories coming from BF theory, and you play this game, you realize that you shouldn't take all two complexes, but you should only take those two complexes such that the embedding map gives you an isomorphism between the first fundamental groups, so for instance, which just means that if the manifold has holes, then the two complex that you embed also should have the same amount of holes. So and those form a subset of which with a partial order, obviously. But that is something which you should look at when you construct your models. That's why I said not all two complexes, but you know all sufficiently nice two complexes.
Since the order on your on the set of two complexes is only partial, does it mean that you have any possible directions for the flow? And if so, or at least
maybe, which way do you flow?
Oh, I flow from the ultraviolet to the infrared. That is.
Do you flow from simple two complexes to complicated two complexes?
No, I flow from complicated two complexes to simple two complexes.
So then the question is, which of the simple two complexes?
So
you actually flow those in which of the. You showed us a tree.
Yeah.
So you go to the reverse of the, on the tree. On which of the branches do you go?
Well, you don't go. And just one of the branches. That's the whole point. I mean, you go on the whole partially ordered set, right? So you don't. That's the point of the whole background independent story. You're not just supposed to look at one, just you know, subset of these. Although obviously in examples, that's exactly what you do, because I mean, there's this uncountable set or so. And what you actually, you know, in practice do is you try to find a very nice representative set of that. So for instance, say hypercubic lattices. Anyway, yeah, and you hope that captures enough information. But what you actually should do if you could and you had infinite time and infinitely powerful computers is that you actually should look at all of these at the same time and look at the relative consistency conditions on all of these at the same time.
Okay, so in the examples that you showed,
yeah.
I missed that point. But then you.
Which one? I mean, like this one, for instance.
Yeah, so you looked actually at a cubic lattice or what?
With this one?
You looked at this particular lattice.
No, I looked at. Here you can look at all lattices at the same time, simply because it's such a simple model that you have no problem of just looking at all two complexes, which are basically just all the tessellations of your two-dimensional manifold. I mean, here this is just such a this is an equation that holds for all gamma and all f. So, but that is a very very simple example, obviously. But just it's an example where you show that you can you know what it means
that's
that
because of the measure that you choose.
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. I mean, this is just because this.
All right, so that would be your blueprint of what you would actually like to do with some.
No, well, in the full quantum gravity theory, I mean, obviously, I mean, there's no way to do that.
You don't want to use that mechanism, obviously, for solving the equation. But
right.
In spirit, that's what you aim at.
So, yes, in spirit, I think that is what.
So you erase the mechanism, mm-hmm. just the premise and the result. You have a measure, and you mm-hmm. and you coarse grain the measure, not any particular. You have a measure. Mm-hmm. On what in loop quantum gravity would call an A bar.
Yes.
And you coarse grain the entire measure, like you mm-hmm. do with some implementation. I mean, you can look at this with measure yeah. configuration space.
Right.
Okay.
So there are, we have another. Oh, la la. Another question there, Jason.
Is there something about memory minimizable theories?
Yeah, well. I could, yes. No, but I mean, I would have just talked about, basically made the statement that it's this additional condition of diffeomorphism invariance is so strong that it actually might constrain lots and lots of the ultraviolet coefficients that you get. So obviously, these models are not non-renormalizable. They're far too simple for that. But there's one effect that crops up, which is very similar in a certain sense, which is... that if you look at these equations, what they do is say, assume you know all the areas of faces up to a certain, say, up to a certain discretization. Now, that doesn't mean you know the metric, because in order to know the metric, which tells you about the whole continuum limit of this solution, it only tells you about the areas of your faces. If you subdivide this face further, you have no idea what these four simple areas are, right? So you just know that their sum should be this area. So in this sense, you know, in each further step of refinement, you get more and more information that you have to supply. The reason for that is obviously because, well, the continuum solution is given by this background metric. You know, so the infinitely many additional coupling constants that you get just give you the additional information of, well, what's the background metric that you build your state on. Sorry, to talk about? Scale. Right.
So the sort of full transition to the discussion that
Well, the
do you have a because that we can get this immediately in the discussion session. So Jan, do you have a different question?
Yeah, I have. So now your models were two dimensional.
Yes.
So
yes.
Now I have a model where it involves you give a weight one to any two dimensional complex. So.
Yes. Yeah. That's one model. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one model. Because the range is just one for each simplex.
Yeah, yes, yes, sure.
Yeah. So there it's no, I mean, a measure exists on the set, can be gathered constructively, exactly. We know that the corresponding continuum quantum field theory is Kalil with two dimensional quantum gravity. So it should be included in your construction, I guess. So you have a measure on all two dimensional kind of planar complexes of let the manifold be S2.
Yes, yes.
We have this ensemble of complexes. We have a measure on this ensemble.
Right.
It's a defined mathematical measure.
Yes.
And we know that the passing method is two dimensional quantum linear. So
now,
you should be able to see it, I guess.
Well, I'm not sure. Well, so as far as I understand what you just described, is you just take the measure just being the Hahn measure on each. No, I don't. Yes, that's right. I don't sum over two complexes. No, I look at different two complexes, and if one is finer than the other, then there's a consistency condition between them. But I don't sum over them.
But in principle, you don't have to sum over these either, because if you take these infinitely, I mean, the limit of infinite many subcomplexes, there is a uniform limit where a generic configuration describes everything. So in this sense, but it seems that this structure. It's not captured at all here, but it should be in a certain way because the sum is not as essential.
Well, I think that, you know, if one were very smart and could actually, you know, formulate the Liouville measure in this context, this is actually what one should do. I'm not sure if it's the state that you just described, but.
I just want to say that it seems to be an important example because this is well known and mathematical rigorous and the half and the. The measure that exists.
Well, if it's a measure on the same space, then it should definitely fit in here.
It is, as is defined, as Jaka says, it is a measure on the set of all complexes, but probably redefined.
Okay.
Now, try to address Roberto's question. Where is the Planck
scale? Okay, so where's the Planck scale? First of all, scale here now doesn't enter unless you say look at where would I have it? If you look at all these, if you for instance look at all these two complexes here and look at only a few of them. For instance, you can say I don't want to look at all of them, but for an approximation or so. I introduce a background metric and only look at a subset of these, and then you're back at something like this lattice gauge theory. So a background structure that you look at, just as a fiducial structure, might actually give you something like this. But then, obviously, I mean, you don't really have to stop at the Planck scale in that sense, right? Because the Planck length might be something like. An expectation value of an operator which measures length at some scale, but You can do this if you want. You can say, well, I only look at this subset of these two complexes, and I don't want to go all the way, but I only want to go to those two complexes which, if in some fiducial metric, have an edge length of L Planck, for instance. And then you get, so to speak, a partial flow through here, and that might lead you into the right direction. Yes. But
invariance you're mentioning, if you think that all the edge lengths have Planck length, what happens when you activate the homomorphism?
Yeah, I mean, well, this is about the continuum limit, right? So this is not about the diffeomorphism invariance. So the measure that you constructed in this continuum limit, I mean, you would have to check whether it's diffeomorphism invariant. And one way to check it, obviously, would be to say, well, I used this additional structure in the construction, but I realize that at the end, when I look at expectation values, for instance, it doesn't really depend on this. I mean, this is what people are doing in the functional renormalization group approach, for instance. So that might be a technical way to, you know, go around the fact that you have to look at infinitely many two complexes. But I agree that, you know, if you just look at this, you know, there's no fixed Planck scale that looks you in the face and says.
Having a background metric in itself doesn't mean that you have a, you know, what the Planck scale is. Sometimes you have to identify some
observable that tells you about how long something is. Right. Okay.
You have matrix, you have observers to tell you geometrical, you have geometrical observers which you can apply, and then you basically have to reconstruct the geometry. You can also measure fluctuations of geometry, and so you would compare between the fluctuation spectrum of the geometry and where the fluctuations are roughly of order one, you would find that as a scale. So that would be a completely dynamic way of
So I guess you can consider this already as the result of the discussion. No?
Okay, possibly. Yeah.
Yes, as far as I understand, the Planck ground is relevant only when you couple gravity to other fields. Otherwise, you don't have a measure of Planck ground.
Why not? I mean,
so
with
gravity only. So gravity only that 1 over LP squared. Mm-hmm. Integral of R. Mm-hmm. So you can rescale this easily, and there's no independent notion of the Planck scale. You can have only gravity. If you couple it to other things, then mm-hmm. they measure the Planck length, and not gravity itself. So I don't think mm-hmm. you can have the notion of Planck length having only gravity. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's true that it's much easier to construct anything which measures length in a diffeomorphism invariant way if you have matter around, because then you can say, well, I want to measure the distance given by the metric between two particles or so. And where the particles are is actually given by some fact that, I don't know, the stress tensor is non-zero of the matter field. You know, that being non-zero, that is a diffeomorphism invariant answer. So if you act with a diffeomorphism on the whole situation, both on the matter field and the metric, obviously you get the same geodesics and you get the same answer, right?
But
should I actually go? No, I mean apparently there are ways just in pure gravity to get, you know, just by considering curvature invariance,
yeah, I mean,
to get diffeomorphism invariance.
Basically, the inverse square root inverse coefficient of the Fritchie scalar in a general expansion.
Let's thank Benjamin again.
Okay, thanks.
And then we can.